Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press, focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host and sports writer for LSJ, joined as always by two guys who almost saw Michigan State basketball end Mike Krzyzewski's career. It is Lansing State Journal sports columnist Graham Couch and Detroit Free Press Michigan State beat writer Chris Solari. Gentlemen, welcome back to Lansing, and I think we have a lot to talk about when it comes to the Michigan State basketball, both how the season finished and into the future. Graham, how are you doing today?
I'm great. It's good. Thought for a few minutes there that Chris and I might be on flights to San Francisco today. But alas, the off season hits abruptly as it always does, and we move on.
Well, when it was when it was a 5-point lead with 5 minutes to go, it definitely looked like you could almost get ready to start scheduling those plane tickets and hotels. But alas, Chris, how are you?
Well, and that would be for the amateurs who hadn't already had those things ready to go for that. But at the same point, if you thought that 5 points with 5 minutes to go was going to hold up, you hadn't been watching the first weekend of the tournament, because I can't recall as many good games, particularly many more good games than blowouts, as we've seen in this tournament. And that Michigan State Duke game, I think it came in with the highest rating TV wise of the weekend. It makes a lot of sense because the drama kept building throughout the game, and those last 10 minutes of that game were really, it reminded me so much of the 2019 game between those two teams that it was astounding. And then obviously it just went the other direction, but it was a fun basketball game to watch.
Yeah, I think I saw that it was, 11 million people watched the Duke-Michigan State game? Is that the number I saw?
I think it was 11.2 million,
yeah. That is a very high number for college basketball, especially in the year of our Lord, 2022, for a second-round NCAA tournament game.
Michigan State had, I think, the highest-rated first-round game, too, if I recall. It was up there. Yep. And the Sunday afternoon, you've got the late afternoon Sunday is the back nine on the Masters time slot. It's a time that people are settled in for sports, and those two teams delivered a compelling game, which the brands of those two programs are strong. And I think people get frustrated with Michigan State sometimes in the last couple of years, but it was very clear covering this that Duke, the way people who cover Duke, and the way people cover college basketball nationally perceive Michigan State as a program in terms of the strength and cachet, is perhaps greater than Michigan State's own fan base realizes. And things take a while. I know that there's some frustration out there a little bit, but this is the first time in this decade that they've had two straight years where they haven't been a contender. And they've been this entire decade in the Champions Classic. And I think that stuff rubs off nationally and takes longer to fall by the wayside than it does locally.
Well, and I think that there were probably a lot more people who had Michigan State from a national standpoint based on that. They felt going into that game that it would be a good game, that it would be a competitive game. I'm not necessarily sure if the people who watch Michigan State like we do, or really like the fans do, on a game in game out basis, felt that way. Cause I felt like there was an undercurrent of Michigan State people who thought this is just going to be a blowout, in Duke's favor, because of the way the ups and downs of the season went. I do though think that, whether some of that is all based on Tom Izzo, or, I think some of it was the way that Tom Izzo coaches in March changes the dynamic of some players. But let's face it, I mean, guys like Marcus Bingham and Joey Hauser and Gabe Brown, those three seniors had very, very good, if it is their final games as Michigan State players, they had a heck of a two games in that NCAA tournament between the three of them. In a lot of ways, the what-if factor, had they have been playing like that collectively and consistently throughout the year, you ask yourself, and I think probably Tom Izzo as well says, geez, how much better could this season have been? Because the clues were there that they could do this, but that they were able to put it together in that Duke game as well as they did. I don't know about you, Graham, but I thought that, you know, we talked up and down over and over about this was the turning point performance all year, and it never really coalesced into a big run, but I thought that was their best game. I thought they played their A game, and Duke needed their A game to beat them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought this was probably their as close to their ceiling as they were going to get. You know, they were a team that at their best when things were, you know, and I understand that, you know, if you get a great game also out of Malik Hall, maybe there's a little more, but the idea that they had, you know, as much going for them with Gabe Brown and Marcus Bingham, and I thought Hauser played another good game, didn't score as much. I thought Max Christie, good second half, you know, Hogarth's foul trouble hurt. I mean, it's possible there's a slightly bit more, but they have not put anything together like this. And it's an example of just, you know, the thing is they really didn't have a star this year. And Hogard might be becoming that. Max Christie down the road may be that. Malik Hall had moments, but wasn't really. And they had a number of guys in who on a given day were. And so you needed a day where most of them were going or several of them were really rolling, and they got that against Duke, and they got a level of grit that they needed to have, and they played with a swagger and a purpose and a sort of a resolve and a counter. Everything Duke did, they countered. You know, when things were teetering a couple times in that game, they countered, and I thought that was impressive. And, you know, for a while, Chris, I thought, boy, if they had not lost Northwestern or won at Illinois, things like that, that they wouldn't have to face Duke so early. But let's be honest, this team was, you put this Duke as a potential Final Eight matchup, Michigan State's still probably not getting there. Like, for this Michigan State team, what they did better at their best was rise up to the other team's level. It didn't really, I mean, the next opponent could be whoever. There's a decent chance Michigan State was going to lose that game. So for them to have this sort of showcase, and I think it takes, I'm not saying it takes the sting out of it because they nearly had it. And this would have been a big deal to get to the Sweet 16 and Coach K's career for this team to have that. But I think that to see that group, those seniors, that team play that well, there's a sense of at least some satisfaction that they reached a certain level where they haven't been.
You know, when you talk about those guys, the Max Christies, the AJ Hogarths and Tyson Walker and Jaden Akins in particular, I think that nucleus next year, this is to me, you know, when you watch that game against Duke, the physical limitations of those players right now were on display. I think this is, I don't know, and we've talked about it ad nauseum for 4 years about this with Marcus Bingham. Should he decide to come back, which, you know, I don't know if any of those three do end up coming back or how many if they do, but like, let's say Bingham does. I mean, this has to be a full summer of weight room for those guys because you saw what the veteran strength of Duke's guards did off the dribble and just powering down on Christie in particular, but Walker at times as well. And, you know, between the conditioning and that's, it's funny to say because Christie played 30 minutes a game, but you could tell that the conditioning wasn't there because this is a kid who spent his entire upbringing and you know, high school career and prospect career before he got to college as a shooter, and the legs weren't there in the shot. So the conditioning piece, I think, also comes with the strength piece in that. And same with Walker. I do think that Walker got a lot more confident as the season went along and being able to use his quickness. And I think that, you know, those 2 years that he spent at Northeastern, if he can get, he's got to condense it a little bit to get into the weight room and kind of do that and build up that little more of that trunk and upper body strength. But I think that they've got, with Trey Holloman coming in, I think they got a chance to be a really, really good backcourt next year.
The thing is, and I don't expect any of the guys to come back. I would be very surprised at this point if any of the players came back.
Graham, can I ask you a quick question before you continue?
Yeah.
Do we think all three of those guys are going to play in the NBA? Do they think they're going to the NBA, or are they just ending their college careers with the year of eligibility left?
My guess is that two of them think they're playing in the NBA or playing professionally, and it's time. And Gabe, and let's keep in mind, Gabe Brown is a better pro prospect on draft boards than Kofi Coburn. So, there, you know, you have to remember, yeah. I mean, do I think Gabe Brown is going to make the NBA? I have no idea. I mean, he's not been a consistent enough shooter to me to be a likely guy to stick for what he is as a player. He'll get a shot. He'll get a look. If not, he'll make a lot of money overseas. Same for Marcus Bingham, who I don't know how much. And I think there is probably more to give in college. And when we look at things from afar, like, why would you give up another year of college? Well, that's another year of class. It's another year of, you know, I mean, it's been a grind, the COVID year, everything. And from outside, it looks like, oh, let's play Michigan State basketball. That looks fun. But it's a lot of work, and you have your moment in college. I also think if Gabe Brown came back, that would hinder some development elsewhere on that roster. I think Bingham's the one guy they could use, especially. I mean, they're a little thin at the four, but I think Malik Hall needs a year, too. I think Malik Hall will be helped by being the guy, by playing a lot of minutes. So I don't think that it really helps the program overall, the development of other guys, to have Joey Hauser and Gabe Brown back. Malik Hall's – or sorry, Marcus Bingham's the one argument, but – from what I understand, he's gone too, and so that leaves him probably needing a big.
And with Bingham, I think you have to also keep in mind that he already gave up an extra year of eligibility by not taking a red shirt, which was so painfully obvious that he needed it in 2019 to physically try and develop a little bit more, and he didn't want it then. So I don't see how he does in the back end, regardless of whether it would help him or not. Get to his ultimate goal. I think that some guys just are ready to be done with college sometimes.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, we talk about I think as a backcourt, they could be tremendous next year. I think what will be fascinating, and they just need to make sure they have the front court to the level that doesn't screw that up, that opportunity.
That to me is going to be a really interesting situation, because now you're talking about a guy in Brown who can play the three or the four. You're talking about the four and five in Hauser and a five in Bingham, with only one big man coming in Jackson Kohler. This is going to be a test of Izzo's flexibility, adaptability, and growth. He's talked a lot about, you know, learning. And you know, even as a coach, him needing to learn certain things. I think that it's kind of in some ways veiled code that he realizes that he needs to go into the portal and get more bigs. And I'm going to be interested to see what his philosophy and thought is on bankrolling scholarships now that he had a year of bankrolling those two, because I think that may have changed as well. I think you almost. Not just him, but I think that coaches around the country were fearing, you know, you're going to have guys going in the portal all the time now, and I don't think it's going to matter what they did. You know, it's just going to be the nature of the beast now that coaches are going to have to adapt and deal with. And if you're losing guys to the portal, you better be doing your due diligence and getting guys in the portal yourself. And big guys aren't easy to get. You know, there's certain. I think the Riley kid a couple years ago. I think of John Harar as the guy that I've brought up quite a bit, but I think that was kind of the one missing piece that they needed, just a sturdy big man in that mold, that old school Tom Izzo mold of power forward centers. Those guys aren't a dime a dozen, particularly at a high level that you would, if you're bringing in a transfer, that you're going to want and need. So I would not be shocked to hear Michigan State kicking the tires on every single big man in the portal. But at the same time, I think they're also going to have to do their due diligence to make sure that those are the kind of guys, the OKGs. You know, if these guys can't take hard coaching, if they can't be prepared physically and mentally to do the things that are needed within that system, I don't know if they'll go after them. I think it's got to be a match. I think that's particularly to play for Tom Izzo. You can't have malcontents who are upset with one thing or another. You have to have a guy who absolutely embraces what that program is and stands for.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the good news for them in that front is that the guys who generally are interested in Michigan State are going to be guys who, I mean, it's not like Tom Izzo hasn't been front and center the last few years. In the last, you know, like they're going to sort of have a sense of what that could be like, and they're also probably going to be people who are seeking a winning situation, and that's why they want to move or something on a bigger stage, something like what you saw against Duke. And and so, yeah, but there's no doubt they've got to add. They've got to bolster their front court. They've got to get some rim protection. You can't – because what you have inside right now is, you know, Julius Marble might take some steps. There might be more left for him to develop. He needs to become – he should be a better rebounder than he is. He needs to become sort of a relentless technician and defender, that somebody who, you know, doesn't have – so many unfavorable matchups, because he's really good against certain guys and then just sort of not fit to battle with others in terms of, you know, I mean, we saw it against Duke, right? And so he's got enough strength and enough quickness that he could be, I think, better against perceived mismatches, even if he's not a great vertical athlete or whatnot. And Sissoko, I think, you know, is a guy who they still, you know, still a project they're working on, who had some moments where he was gave them more than just being worth five fouls. But I don't think you can trust either one of those things happening. And the other guy, Jackson Kohler, is a really, really intriguing offensive basketball prospect who I think could be a lot of fun to watch in his time at MSU. But defensively, I don't know what he'll be as a freshman. And so you're relying on a lot of unknowns when, you know, this is a two-year group. The reason – you know, I've been sort of, I don't want to say, I mean, I've been hard on them occasionally, but also sort of from the beginning thinking this was a two-year group. Well, next year you go with a different caliber of expectation, I think, from the jump. And you next year should be a year where you're in contention again. And next year you should have the backcourt with Hogard and Walker and Akins and Christie. And I'm talking about three spots there, too, to really make a move. And you know, you're hoping Pierre Brooks gets into that, and if Trey Holloman carves out a role, that's great too. I don't think there's going to be a ton of point guard minutes to be had, but there's a lot of that could be a dynamic, versatile, extremely good backcourt, and you've got to make sure you have a front court that doesn't hold that back.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see how Brooks translates, and where do you play him? Do you play him predominantly at the three? You know, he's physically sturdy enough, but does he have the physical abilities to play an undersized four?
Right.
You know, and you obviously got Malik Hall, who I think also needs another year in the weight room to kind of – I thought Gabe Brown did a good job remaking his body in the off season. I think Malik Hall needs to do that as well, get more upper body strength and not get knocked off the block so easily if he's going to be playing the four like that. I think that, you know, and anybody you bring in, I think needs to do the same thing. I mean, Sissoko's got all the physical tools, but he is very green basketball wise, and you've seen it every time he plays. You know, he had points where at the end of the year where his minutes were starting to increase a little bit, but I thought it was also telling that they didn't go to him against Banchero and Williams in that game at all. You know, there's a trust factor on the defensive side that needs to be there, and you know, that comes from reps, that comes from understanding and learning that gap defense. And, you know, it's a critical, critical off season for him in particular.
Yeah, I mean, if I could pick one play that really encapsulates the Michigan State big man issue, it's that play with under 2 minutes to go when, you know, Duke takes the 75-74 lead in the call. I don't know if this is the play call, but it ended up being Hauser underneath going through the lane trying to get a layup on Banchero, and Banchero just blocks it with incredible ease, and that leads to the Roach three-pointer next possession. It's a four-point game. All of a sudden, the tide has turned. So that's the play that really stood out to me that really is like, yeah, this big man thing is I mean, it's been a show all year, but really signified that.
Well, even the play before that with Hogard driving in, I mean, you know, there was you go straight up into a seven-foot-one guy as a 6'4 guard. There was no attempt to move or make a move around him. And all Williams did was just go straight up and down on him and anchor himself on the block. You know, that comes from another year of learning, I think, as well, and strength, because he wasn't getting any calls as it was, Hogard, when he was making a lot of drives, even though it was quite a bit of contact at times. So, but particularly, you're right, from the big standpoint, that was a good example. And I don't think Hauser, you know, in many situations is going to be taking anybody off the bounce. I'm not sure what happened on that play.
Yeah. I mean, not to criticize Hauser. He was great for a lot of stretches on the game offensively. And, you know, I want just a quick point about Gabe Brown. You talked about him being NBA ready. I mean, he hit those first four. He hit his first four 3-point attempts, and you know, he was getting out. He was leaking out on the break as well. And those are the type of things that NBA teams are going to want to see. And I guess that's what makes him an intriguing prospect as well.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he's wiry, he's long. I always thought the real question for Gabe Brown is, you know, there are lots of guys built like him who sort of have his skill set who stick in the league. What the guys who actually make it do is make 40%+ of their three-pointers. And so that's really what it comes down to, is will he be that – can he be that consistent at the next level when that's your role? And I don't know that he can. He hasn't shown that in college to this point. So that would be the – but it doesn't mean he won't be an end-of-second-round pick. You know, somebody that the – or a guy who gets certainly a spot on a summer league and gets a look and that's all stuff that, you know, I'm happy for those guys because they did finish with their best. They absolutely did. I mean, what Hauser did in that Davidson game, and I thought he played well, and then those two guys, Bingham and Brown, in the Duke game.
Yeah, Bingham hit two threes against Duke. I don't think anybody had that on their bingo card at all.
Well, and he was funny. Yeah, he was joking about all these big guys like who were supposed to be great, and he's like, "Well, I'm that too." And he was, and credit to him. I mean, he wasn't that all year, all the time, and that's part of the reason they were in the spot they were in. But he was at the end.
Yeah, he really. I thought he was the most impressive parts of Marcus Bingham's game, the last two games in particular, and really the last six games was the different level of intensity that he brought, because he was clogging passing lanes, he was moving defensively, he was not just blocking shots but using his wingspan to get deflections, to do all, you know, all the little things, attacking the loose ball rebounds, things that he had been hearing for 3.5-4 years that were finally, you know, it took that light switch coming on that this is probably going to be my end at Michigan State, so I want to go out with a flourish. And I think he had three double-doubles in his last six games, which, yeah. You know, had he been able to do that consistently, you know, who knows what. I mean, because a seven-footer with showing that kind of range, you know, teams look for those kind of things. So I don't know where his future lies, which I think is going to be, you know, I think this next month – for those guys is going to be particularly interesting. Does something change where they have conversations and one or two of them stay? Do they see that they need more refinement and try and go somewhere else? I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that could happen between now and I feel like, you know, the end of April, where these guys will announce their determinations and maybe it's just that they're ready to go pro and make some money on it.
I mean, you're right. I mean, the timetable in college has changed so much that you never know what conversation could be had. But I would bet my mother's house today that all three are gone.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind too is that Hauser does have the potential for another year beyond this because of enrolling early and taking that half year red shirt at Marquette. So if he wanted to, he could petition for an injury eligibility. I don't know if he does. But you could see, I saw many differences in him, you know, in that final game against Duke, when there was a point where he was getting subbed out and he is frantically screaming and yelling at the bench that he doesn't want to come out, that he wants to stay in the game. And I don't know if we would have seen that from Joey Hauser 2 months ago or maybe even 2.5 weeks ago. But he found something. So, you know, it has to be with these guys, they have to want to be able to stay in college, which I don't know if any of them do. I mean, that's, you know, 4 years in college is a long time for guys. 5 years is longer. And, you know, not everybody's Jordan Bohannon, who can stay there for 7, 8, 9 years like him and Brad Davidson.
I was just going to mention Brad Davison as well, definitely in that category. Well, I do want to bring up one guy who we really haven't talked about. He's been mentioned, and we talked about the guards a little bit, is A.J. Hogard. I just thought these last two games against Davidson and Duke, like he looked like a star point guard that he was recruited to be, but that blocked layup against Duke notwithstanding, he was driving to the lane confidently, and most importantly, two things, finishing said drives and not turning the ball over, which two things we weren't seeing on a consistent basis during the regular season. And I was just really impressed with Hogard, and I think he's just ready to take the next step and be kind of a leader next season for the Spartans. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree with that.
I agree. I mean, he's been, it's not, it, he gets in the lane, he's trouble for people. What's amazing about him is that, you know, he's not a threat yet to shoot the three, really. And yet he can still, you can't keep him out of the lane, and he's a menace now when he gets in there, and some of the passes he's firing away in there, and the shot, I thought the real mistake they made, if any, against Duke was that they did not play him enough early. They needed to settle him down for a minute, but then the minute allocation in the first half, where they were only down four and they kind of got away with it. But I thought he needed to be in there more. And it's not that Walker didn't play well. He did. He played extremely well. And they played, you know, together, obviously, some. And I think that's an interesting option. But Hogard is a guy who, because of his personality and sort of his unwavering, never-ending confidence, that now that he's sort of reined that in, it's no longer just – I used to think it was sort of delusion as much as confidence. And now it's he looks like he is – on the precipice of being a really, really, really special player.
I thought the one play that really kind of showed his growth was after Duke tied it up. It very well easily could have been a turnover where the ball got deflected into the backcourt and the shot clock was winding down, and he not only chased down the loose ball and beat the Duke player to it, but then quickly came back up court and scored in traffic, which was a heck of a play. And there was another play early in the game. The block shot that he had on Mark Williams that, you know, he probably got arm on it, whatever, but that wasn't the impressive play to me. The impressive play to me was he gets the block, falls to the ground, and is back up and going in transition. That's a Tom Izzo point guard right there. That was the moment where I thought A.J. Hogard showed that he is capable of doing the things that Izzo wants from a toughness and quickness standpoint. It's a play that kind of gets forgotten because of the block, because of how the game went, but his ability to get back up and go is, you know, that's what this team needs from a leadership standpoint. That's, I think he's going to be good. I do think that the one thing in that game, I think they waited maybe a little too long to go with the Hogard-Walker combination. They probably could have and should have interspersed it a little bit more, maybe in the earlier in the second half or even at times in the first half. But I thought that Michigan State's offense was its most dynamic with those two in there. And I mean, when they got their run to start taking the lead, those two were the guys that were in there together. And Hogard picking up his fourth foul kind of changed their ability to do that and forced them to kind of do some things substitution-wise that they had to go away from it. And you wonder if that didn't cost some momentum at that point.
There wasn't a momentum changer like that Illinois game where the guy got called for the technical foul on the slam dunk or something. The officiating feels like it's always a big talking point. Did you guys feel like that was a factor in this game? Because it feels like it was a factor in many, many other NCAA tournament games this past weekend.
There was a few fouls late and rapid. I mean, you know, and Krzyzewski's obviously won his 1,200th game. Probably 200 of them were very well helped by the officials, you know, I'd say. But that's sort of I didn't think there was anything egregious in this particular game. The Illinois technical foul is one where that official shouldn't work again, because you can't, like, that's an instinct that if you have, you shouldn't be officiating. Like, why would you have that instinct? Like, it's not really a judgment call. It's you choosing to look at a situation and almost wanting to call a technical and interject yourself in the game. And if that's where your instinct is, then you cannot be officiating games, like, ever again. If you do something really bad in life, you can't just brush it off and say, well, I shouldn't have done that. Well, no doubt. But there's a, you know, there are consequences for it. For that official, that was an egregious decision. I know we're just getting a little off topic, but that has bothered me more and more since I've seen the replay, and how that person could remain as an official.
Yeah, the only reason I wanted to mention it was because everyone's favorite Big Ten official, Bo Borowski, was the lead official for the game, and everyone on social media was
Graham's favorite official.
Yeah, Graham's favorite official too. Everyone was freaking out about it, and it didn't really seem like to be much of a factor in the game. So I at least from my perspective, I'm with you on that, Graham.
I mean, there was the one point where there were 3 fouls in 13 seconds, including two with the clock stop, but that's a whole other thing. I mean, that can happen in any game. I thought those were ticky-tack calls, but ticky-tack calls happen both ways. I thought, let me put it this way, it was poorly officiated at times in both directions. That said, I think the foul count was, to me, it went a little bit more with Michigan State's style of play. You know, Duke was playing physical too, though, and they weren't getting some of the whistles. But, you know, was it the difference in the game? No, I think Duke's NBA talent was the difference in that game.
Yeah, and when you transpose the Davidson and Michigan State games, it was at the same points, you know, going different ways where the game got took over. Like, Michigan State really took over the Davidson game in that stretch right before the 4-minute timeout, and then like the 90 seconds after the coming back from the timeout where they were able to stretch that lead up to, I think, 6 or 7. Remember correctly? And that was at the same spot where Duke made their comeback and you know, really kind of put Michigan State back on its heels. So I just thought it was interesting transposition there. I don't even think that's a word, but you guys get what I'm saying. Maybe not. Maybe you don't get what I'm saying. All right. Do you guys want to talk about Fletcher Lawyer Davidson for a few minutes here? Or?
We haven't talked since the Davidson game. I think that was that's a part of this season. That's a part of this journey that was, Davidson's a really good team. They were better than I thought. They were. I mean, I watched them play a fair number of times this year. I watched them play in person once against a bad team, albeit. I thought it was a good matchup for Michigan State and Davidson. There was a toughness to them, that Michigan State, you know, had to really counter to win that game. And I was impressed.
Yeah, and I thought Michigan State did a good job. I mean, they took Brockovich out of that game early, got him into foul trouble. But then in the second half, you saw what kind of player he was. I mean, he was scoring at times at will, which, again, I think shows the need for strength, the need for depth and talent in the post from Michigan State's standpoint on both ends, not just offensively. I thought they did a pretty good job on shutting down Lee and forcing him into some tough, bad shots at times. And then I think what we saw with the Foster Lawyer, situation, you want to call it, you saw there that he's at the right spot. Because there were moments, particularly late in that game, where Michigan State's guards were just physical with him and pestered and bothered him, and he made some of the same Foster Lawyer mistakes that he made for the previous 2 years when he was playing at Michigan State, where falling on the ground and, you know, that one play under the basket that should have been travel that wasn't called, the shot that went over the backboard. So I think there was some moments in that game where granted, he hit a couple big shots late. There's no question about that. I mean, I thought he showed tremendous resolve with those issues that he was having, and they were all over him from start to finish in that game defensively. But I thought that he showed some mental toughness and resolve. It's funny how, you know, you could see your transition, as you will, or translation, or transposition, yes, whatever you want to call it. The difference between the Foster Lawyer and the bigger guards that Michigan State had versus Michigan State's guard versus the NBA type guards that Duke has. I mean, I thought it was a linear thing where you look at that and you see who should be at who's at what level, right? I think when Izzo says they need to get to that next level, I think it's, you know, getting stronger as a group, not just physically either, sometimes mentally. And, you know, I thought there was a good line in terms of those two teams that they played, of where they're at right now and where they need to get to, what they need to do to get there, too.
Yeah, I thought, you know, that Michigan State really did a good job of shutting down the guards, Lee and Lawyer, but, I mean, they've had problems with big men all season, and even though he was the conference player of the year, Davidson's big man just, when he wasn't in foul trouble, just could do what he wanted. And then the dude with the broad shoulders, number three, whose name I don't remember, was
Sam Manninga.
Yes, canning corner threes out of nowhere. And I know there was some talk on MSU.
Yeah, that wasn't out of nowhere. That wasn't out of nowhere, though. You might have looked at his season stats and thought that. But he had, in that game against Richmond, it hit 4 of 4.
Yeah,
you knew he was coming in with a hot hand. And he was also taking him off the bounce. I thought he attacked Joey Hauser quite a bit. Off the dribble, particularly in the first half.
Yeah, he was like a 45% three-point shooter, but he had not attempted that many three-pointers. So I think that's where maybe that's where I was thinking in terms of maybe a little surprising. And I know that going back to Laurie here, MSU Twitter was like, they basically just wanted Hogard and Walker to take him to the lane every time, and they were mad that Michigan State wasn't doing that. Do you think Michigan State was just taking it easy on him in that regard, or do you think they really should have tried to exploit his defensive liabilities more than they did? Because it really didn't seem like they tried to drive on him too much.
I mean, I thought they did a fair bit here and there especially with Hogard. But it also speaks to who Michigan State is not this year. I mean, they are not a team, and they're a jump shooting team that doesn't do that well, you know, and it you don't change your stripes all of a sudden. I don't think they took it easy on him. I felt bad for him. I felt bad for his experience. And, you know, this is going to happen more and more. You know, I don't think it's anything that the committee necessarily paired together. I just think this is going to happen more and more when more guys transfer, and you're going to wind up with interesting pairings like this. But I'm glad he has another year if he wants it, because and I don't know if they'll get back to the tournament. They lose a few key guys. But, I don't think that was an entirely enjoyable experience all the way around for him.
Oh, totally. I could see it when I was asking him about certain things before the game. And, you know, he kind of is like, I disagree with that. I don't think that it's a Foster Lawyer against Michigan State or his former teammates or Tom Izzo. It's Davidson against Michigan State. You could tell it was weighing on him. And that's not fair for a kid, particularly a kid who gave you could say whatever you want about his physical limitations, but that kid gave his heart to that Michigan State program and, you know, wanted to be there and you know, for 3 years did everything he needed to and really helped, you know, Cassius Winston during the hardest time of his life, that people sometimes don't think about those components of it. And Izzo had said, you know, he really hopes that Foster Lawyer someday comes back as a graduate assistant. And I don't think that's just lip service either. I think he really likes the kid, and I don't think that you shouldn't like the kid. You know, just because he's not what anybody else thought he would be, or you know, maybe the expectations others had weren't the same for him, or maybe there was a misreading of his talent from the coaching standpoint. That's not anything about who Foster Lawyer is. And I thought, it was great to see him hit those shots late to keep them in it and keep their hope alive, because it would have been a terrible experience if he'd gone out with just that trip and fall under the basket. I think he was able to at least get a little bit of positive thing. And you could tell after the game with the hugs and the handshakes and everything just how much Foster Lawyer meant to those guys and to those coaches.
Yeah, he only had 6 points late until those two late baskets that kind of upped his point total a little bit. So let me ask you guys this. I know, well, there's still going to be a lot of shaking out between other teams and who transfers, who departs for the league or whatever, but where do you kind of see Michigan State being ranked in the preseason poll next season? Is this a top 25 team? Is this a top 15 team?
Sure. Oh, it will be based on brand, certainly, and I think the way they finish against Duke, and they'll have enough key recognizable names. The preseason rankings are basically based on momentum at the end of the year and recognizable names coming back. And Michigan State will have all of that. They'll have Max Christie, they'll have Hogard, they'll have Malik Hall, they'll have And they'll have the game against Duke that people remember with all those guys coming back. And so, they'll have things to prove, and it won't be a top 10 team, but I can see it being somewhere in the, 14 to 20 range in the preseason pool.
I can't see anything. I can't see anything at all because, what was it, Texas that went out and loaded up when they hired Chris Beer on transfers and all of a sudden found themselves, bumped up into the top 15 or whatever out of nowhere. That the transfer portal changes these and I've never liked the too early rankings as it is because there's so much that happens now in the off season and that I think that, between guys going to the NBA and turning pro and guys transferring schools and, guys reclassifying, going from junior classes to right to college, I think you just cannot peg it. I think, right now, just based on what's there right now and everything, I'd say they'd be a top 20, top 15 type team. But that's going to change. I mean, it's, Izzo could go out and get two dynamite transfers and all of a sudden maybe you're talking top 10. I don't know. I mean, let's face it. I know a lot of people have said, Izzo's stubborn about things and whatever. Listen, Izzo's embraced transfers more than people realize. All the way back to Brandon Wood and Joey Hauser and Bryn Forbes and Tyson Walker. It's not that he's not embracing it. Believe me, there's got to be that fit. I think that's, he's bemoaned the athletes a lot, not specifically, but generally this generation of athletes, which is kind of, older coaches do that no matter what. But I think he still has a concept of what he wants and what type of player makes his program successful. And he's going to find them, whether it's, he's not anti-transfer portal. Let's put it that way.
Let's branch away from Michigan State basketball here for a couple of minutes, because I want to ask you about just the Big Ten and the NCAA tournament in general. Michigan and Purdue were the only two teams to make it to the second weekend, and there seemed to be a big dunk party after we saw four Big Ten teams lose on the same day. And do you just kind of feel like this is about what it should be for the Big Ten in terms of this year anyway, in terms of just two in the Sweet 16? Or did the Big Ten, like last year, lay a humongous egg in the postseason once again?
The SEC was worse, you can argue. The Big Ten's got two. But no, this was bad. This was, to me, I'm probably, and look, I don't think that the tournament in a snapshot is a fair representation of conference. It's about matchups individually. But 2 years in a row, your best teams have flamed out for the most part. Not Purdue, but a lot of them, Illinois particularly, and Iowa this year, and Wisconsin to some degree, and match with it should have worked. And so I don't think that says anything about the depth. I'm cool with the coach talking about the depth. I just don't want to hear that you're the best at the top. I just don't think you're high end. And I think the style of big man ball that they play in a lot of these teams isn't helping them when they get to the next round. That's not necessarily what happened to Iowa or Wisconsin, but Illinois 2 years in a row, the Kofi thing doesn't do you any good, it didn't do any good for Luka Garza. And I'm not saying you don't recruit big men. I'm just saying that until the Big Ten has a little more, and I'm not somebody who believes you have to have national championships. I mean, if you look at the last two decades, the last 7 years, last 8 years, the Big Ten is as good as any league there is in terms of putting teams in the Final Four. But these last 2 years, until they have some second weekend success, I just don't want to hear it. I just don't, because this is, you can say, well, it's not the talents matchups, then it's coaching, it's something. They have not performed at this level, and it's 2 years of it.
It'll be interesting to see how it changes in 2 weeks if, Purdue makes the run and wins it all. I mean, it's been since 2000 since Michigan State won it that a Big Ten team has done it. But, if there's any team that's had the depth and talent to do so, I think that Purdue's got as good a case as anybody that the Big Ten's had recently. particularly this year with everything being so all over the map. And, you know, there's obviously a pretty decent path for them there. So, I mean, if Purdue gets there, I mean, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, yeah, sure, it's, you know, it looks a lot better for the Big Ten. But you know, the first weekend exits, I mean, was it Sunday Bloody Sunday, you may as well say, for the Big Ten. You know, I mean, it was, you know, I don't think anyone should be surprised by Wisconsin. Iowa maybe a little bit, but, you know, I think there's always that issue with Iowa in terms of when is the fade going to come? When's the Fran fade going to come? And this year it just happened to come the first weekend of the tournament. Feel sorry for those people who were foolish enough to put Iowa in their Final Four. No names mentioned. But listen, Kentucky lost to St. Peter's. So, yeah. You know, is it a Big Ten problem, or are we talking about a crazy year around the country where anything could happen because of parity, because of guys getting fifth years with COVID and everything else? I mean, there's a lot of things I think you could see. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't write off the Big Ten as not being up there, because I do think the depth of the conference is still there. But that said, you know, this wasn't a good look by any stretch of the imagination this year. But, you know, come fall, you'll probably see 6 or 7 top 25 Big Ten teams. So that's just the nature of the beast.
Par for the course. And you mentioned Kentucky lost. Baylor also lost. Arizona almost lost its second round game to TCU. So it's just it's a cup.
Gonzaga,
yeah.
Gonzaga almost lost to Memphis. It's not a singular thing. There's quite a bit.
It's a single elimination tournament. This is how things go. It's chaos.
And my issue is not so much the Illinois loss. It's how they played.
Oh, they played terrible.
Yes. If Illinois lost a game like the Michigan State Duke game to a really good Houston team in a 4-5 matchup, and we left and said, wow, that was a great game. Too bad for Illinois. That wouldn't be a referendum. But Illinois is too, you know, and there's some questions. And I know if you look at the data on the Big Ten tournament champions in recent years, they've actually done fairly well. But these are 2 years now where the team that was most invested, I think, in getting it done the weekend before with 4 straight wins or 3 straight wins, Illinois and then Iowa, didn't bring it, you know, early in the Big Ten tournament, or in the NCAA tournament. And again, of the many reasons the Big Ten tournament, if you've already done it, if you're solidified, is worth checking out of and is not a true conference championship, it's right there. Because I don't see how Iowa was so motivated, so driven, so efficient for several weeks going into that tournament and then that tournament, and then to have, you know, that showing, I don't know. That was really disappointing for the league, I think.
And yet Michigan is there. I mean, that's
right.
You know, that it's all about coming together at the right time of the year and having the talent to do so. And, you know, some teams peak early, some teams peak late, but, you know, what happens with Michigan will be interesting. I mean, I'm really curious to see, can they sustain it? Can they make an 89-type run? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, there's talent there. But, you know, that doesn't get any easier. Texas Tech's a hell of a team.
Yeah.
You know, that's not an easy challenge for them, or excuse me, Villanova. I'm sorry, I was thinking of the wrong bracket. I was thinking about the Michigan State bracket. No, the Villanova team. I mean, I had Villanova in my Final Four. They're still alive. All of my Final Four are still alive. How's your brackets doing?
Yeah, I'm horrible. I'm near the bottom of everything I'm in.
I'm near the bottom of everything I'm in too. But I still have 3 of my Final Four teams.
I've got all 4. I had Gonzaga, I had Arizona, I had Villanova, and Kansas, I believe, was the other one. And Kansas obviously has, I mean, they can get past Providence. It's, you know, a 10 or 11, even if Iowa State and Miami are playing well. And, you know, Nova and Arizona will be an interesting game. I guess Purdue was my other one, not Arizona. I have Villanova knocking off Arizona to get there, but Purdue is my other one in that bracket. And, you know, they got to beat that vaunted St. Peter's team that is America's Cinderella right now. And then UNC and UCLA on the other side of it. So,
yeah. if I know my Purdue basketball history like I think I do, St. Peter's is going to win that game. Purdue tends to lose weird A-word college basketball games in the postseason in the NCAA tournament.
It's absolutely true. Well, it'll be interesting to see, because I think this is, you know, that Carson Edwards team a couple years ago, I think they got to the Elite Eight and they were close, but I think this is their best chance.
They had that game won.
Yeah.
And they blew it.
This is their best chance, and this is a chance. If you want about a year where history sometimes doesn't matter, this could be it. I'm not sure Krzyzewski's team gets past Texas Tech, to be honest. I mean, that could be the end of his career on Thursday.
By the way, I had Iowa, Baylor, and somebody else has lost too.
Oh boy,
Kentucky.
No, I had Gonzaga and Arizona. I don't know who the hell knows, but it was not pretty. And these are the hardest things to predict, this tournament, and every year. I mean, that's what makes it so great, and that's what makes it so dangerous to really, you know, judge programs and teams by a singular result. Over time, though, I think it's fair. It's sort of like a plus-minus number in a college basketball game, you know. And in a snapshot, you can justify just about anything. You can understand why things happen. It's a single game. And but, you know, it's also – to bring it back to Michigan State is why Izzo was so revered in the month for a while is there is something to being able to win a lot of these matchups that are such a crapshoot and so difficult to – against so many different kind of matchups and you know, they had runs. I think what built Izzo's legacy beyond the three first Final Fours in a row was also the runs they had sort of unexpectedly. You know, the 03 run and, you know, the 15 run.
05.
Yeah, it was 03, 05, 15. Am I right? Yeah, 03, 05, 15 are the three that were sort of out of nowhere. And those runs really bolster, because not a lot of coaches have three runs of you know, Elite Eight or Final Four in them off teams that at one point in the year were those weren't bad teams, but weren't considered that, you know. So
I thought the one thing of the weekend that I thought was fascinating in hindsight was going into the Greenville bracket and listening to Bob McKillop, Davidson's coach, talking about it. He'd known Jim Larrañaga for years, and Larrañaga told him, said, oh, maybe it's a good omen. The last time they had been in the same first two rounds was back in 2005. I believe it was, I think it was 06, the year that Larrañaga's George Mason team knocked off Michigan State and made that surprise run to the Final Four, and lo and behold, Larrañaga's Miami team knocks off Auburn to go to the Sweet 16 as a 10 seed. So it was pretty prescient that he kind of saw that. And, you know, who knows? Hot teams right now, I don't know how much, you know, I don't know how much double-digit seeding means sometimes at this point anymore, just because of the parity that's evolved and the way the transfer portal has changed some things. But would it surprise me if I saw at least one double-digit seed reach New Orleans?
Do you guys want to change your national title picks based on the first two games, or are you guys confident? I think you guys both picked Gonzaga, is that right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have any idea, nor do I, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. I'm stuck with Villanova for whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I've got all four of my final four teams left, you know. And once again, that is Gonzaga, Villanova, Purdue, and the other team that I have.
Perfect way to end this podcast. Do you guys have any final thoughts before we sign off here?
Not a one.
I've seen you yawning about every two or three minutes here through the course of this recording.
That's so, not true. I don't believe it. He's making stuff up.
It's been a long week. Yeah. Kansas was my other one, by the way. You know, I think it's important we just briefly touch on spring football, because we'll be getting back into that going into this week. I mean, we talked to some coaches and players last week. You know, Mel Tucker, obviously, last Monday and before practices started, and Peyton Thorne and Jaden Reed and a couple of the other guys. And, you know, there's a lot of buzz with the team. probably the most buzz I've seen around a spring football since I've been around. But at the same time, it is still spring football. It is still practice. It's a building block phase. So make sure you keep that in mind, and we'll have a lot more coming at LSJ.com and Freep.com here in the next couple weeks leading into that April 16th spring game. We'll talk to some players on Thursday, and there'll be stuff coming over the weekend.
There you go. What a preview from Chris. A lot of football content coming his way. Just what he's ready to do, coming right off the NCAA, or coming off the NCAA tournament in Michigan State basketball season.
Secretly, that's the one reason I wanted to go to San Francisco's one more week to wait on spring football. But it's here. Graham, it's football season. I know you love it.
It is not football season. I will respect that people are fired up about it, but I refuse to enjoy it.
All right. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at LSJ.com, Freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, @Chris Solari, @Phil_Friend, and LSJ Green White. Thanks for listening.